Chapter 17. The Descent. All night the station has been busy, the floodlights turning this underground kingdom into eternal day. The mission-critical Enterprise servers used by Biogenesis are enormous, and there are 58 of them along with associated equipment. Network appliances, data centers, operating systems, cooling systems, mile upon mile of cables. Dismantling it all has been the work of weeks, and yet it must be transferred in just days. Every single machine packed, appropriately, in memory foam, crated up, labelled, checked, secured. It's as if the brain and beating heart of Biogenesis have been transplanted. The crates being carried down 20 floors by a small army of workmen contain perhaps 1 billion gigabytes of memory. Here is the germline gene therapy being pursued by the scientists in Section 14. The results of genome manipulation which could lead to the creation of a new species. The industrial fermentation which will allow food manufacturers to grow their own protein. 10 years of genome research. Bioreactor development. Every time the goods lifts reach platform level, another building block is spirited away. And soon it will be as if the entire history of Biogenesis has disappeared. It will be safer in Scotland. 500 meters underground, where the natural rock ceiling will insulate it all from any human intervention. The maglev train is due to depart in a matter of hours, and sits patiently beside the platform, almost purring as its carriages are filled. This time there will be no passengers. The train does not even need a driver. Once the doors have been sealed, it will slide through the tunnel, passing directly beneath the Shard. The tunnel runs all the way to Finsbury Park, where it will finally surface with its own inbuilt computer systems directing it on its 500-mile journey north. The train is going through its last-minute checks, even as the crates arrive. White-coated technicians have connected their laptops to the maglev's operating systems, while engineers in the light-green overalls of Biogenesis support staff tap at the wheels, check the seals, examine every exposed mechanical part to ensure that all is in order. For once, the station's security cameras are out of action. The managers at Biogenesis have put it out that there has been a technical malfunction, and they are working to restore surveillance, but this is not true. The cameras have been deliberately disabled. There is every chance that the Red Circle will have hacked into the system. They do not want the enemy to see what they are doing. The screens are therefore blank in Mycroft's office, 15 floors above. Jonathan Bloor is with him. He is, as usual, dressed in one of his well-tailored suits, this one a black undertaker's weave, with the watch chain in place. But he is not comfortable. Failure is not part of his vocabulary, and there are many lesser employees he has fired, without notice or benefits, and with no hope of future employment, for offences much lesser than the one he himself committed the night before. He was tasked with bringing Sherlock Holmes back into captivity. He let him get away. Since then, he has pored over what happened. He has remembered every detail. There was surely nothing else he could have done. The threat of suicide was too real, and Holmes at large was still a preferable option to Holmes dead. He had no other choice. But he also knows that the question of whether he is right or wrong is irrelevant. It is never healthy to be the bearer of bad news, particularly when you are working for a man like Mycroft. Bloor understands the world he is in. There are many young, ambitious executives who have been waiting for him to fall. They would love to see him turned out onto the street, and they may already have been there, whispering in Mycroft's ear, lobbying to take his place. Bloor has no friends. He doesn't need them. He enjoys much more the pleasure of making new enemies. And he is safe. Mycroft may be the brain of Biogenesis, but Bloor is very much its dark heart, and knows too many of its secrets. More than that, he has done many things in his role as chief operating officer. Horrible things. And Mycroft has always been able to rely on him, because there are no limits to what he will do, no order he will refuse. He has, however, been surprised. The chief executive officer of Biogenesis has seemed almost amused by the story of what happened at Paddington Old Cemetery, lounging in his oversized executive chair with his feet on the desk. As usual, he is wearing trainers, this time with a Dino Caprice polo shirt and mycelium slacks. He waits until Bloor has finished speaking, then twists his gold signet ring and asks, What did you say he's calling himself?
Sherlock Holmes.
He's taken my name. How delightful. You must think of me as a brother.
Or a father.
What about Sherlock? That seems a very strange choice.
Law shrugs. I have no idea.
You said there was someone else with him.
According to Irene Adler, his name is Dr. John Watson. We've checked, and there was a hospital porter of that name, not a doctor, working at St. Thomas's Hospital. He had lodgings in Pimlico, but left after he fell out with his landlord. Destination unknown. Apparently he drinks, and he hasn't a penny to his name.
And Sherlock Holmes, if that is what we are to call him, has no idea where he came from?
Blore nods.
This Watson character said he'd been ill. It's interesting that at the very end, he asked me about Moriarty. He clearly remembers the name, but has no idea who he is.
The two can't have seen each other, then.
I'm not so sure about that. That's something else Irene Adler told me. We're not the only ones looking for him.
Who else?
You know how she works. She never names people, but she made it clear to me that we weren't the first to come calling at the Bohemia.
That's interesting. Did she speak to them too?
She assures me not, and I believe her. She only spoke to us because it was us.
Well, it looks like we're going to have to leave Mr. Sherlock Holmes to his own devices for the time being. We have rather more serious issues on our hands right now. The train will be leaving on time?
To the minute.
Good.
Mycroft nods. He has a health shot, ginger and ginseng, in a glass in front of him. He picks it up and throws it back, then repositions himself with his feet on the floor. He leans forward.
I have to say I'm a little disappointed, Jonathan, he says. I gave you a job to do. It was fairly simple as far as I can see.
Suddenly the extraordinary energy, the ruthless self-confidence that separates him from everyone else in the building, blazes in his eyes.
You screwed up.
I explained.
I think nonetheless that you need some time to yourself to reflect on what happened.
Blore stares at Mycroft. His own dark eyes have become darker. A cloud of cold malevolence hangs between the two men.
What are you suggesting?
He asks in a low voice.
Relax, Mycroft smiles. As a matter of fact, I've decided to promote you.
He pauses.
I'm putting you in charge of the Kilmorack facility.
In Scotland?
That's the one. You can travel up with the servers, which will be an extra level of security for the transfer. Once you're there, you'll be in charge of the day-to-day running of the place. The staff, security. I'm thinking of a pay rise. Shall we say 5%? And of course, you'll have your own corner office.
Blore swallows hard.
The offices are underground.
Well, yes, but I'll make sure you're allowed up for a couple of hours in the sunlight every Thursday afternoon. It's a great shame you allowed Sherlock Holmes to make a fool of you in the way he did, but I'm sure you'll have plenty of time to reflect on it in your new position.
And suppose I were to refuse your kind offer?
Would that really be a good idea, Jonathan?
Kilmorack is not, I agree, the most interesting place in the world. In fact, I'm told there's nothing there at all. Goats and rain, but it's better, surely, than the alternative.
Which is?
Mycroft spreads his hands.
Early retirement.
In the world of biogenesis, that could mean many things.
Blore has one last try.
I'd prefer to stay with you, he says.
That's very loyal of you, but we'll talk to each other regularly on HoloLink, so it'll be almost the same. And who knows when you might be back?
The threat is implicit, but so is the promise.
Blore quickly weighs up the options and nods his head.
Very well, Mycroft. Whatever you say.
I knew I could rely on you.
Mycroft gets to his feet and frowns at the empty TV screens.
I don't like having the TV cameras turned off in the station.
That was your decision.
Yes, but would you mind popping down to the platform? It's not that I'm worried or anything. The security planning for this operation has been watertight.
but it's always good to have eyes on the ground. In fact, Mycroft is wrong. The tiny microphone concealed in Blore's tooth has transmitted this conversation as it has many others, and he has made another serious miscalculation in his planning. He has assumed that Red Circle is unaware of his plan to move the servers, and he has designed all his security arrangements around that single misapprehension. Mycroft believes that the Red Circle do not know that he is double-crossing his business partners and sending his servers to a safe place, and so, in his mind, they have no reason to punish him, perhaps by attacking his train. None of this is true. The Red Circle agent is already on the platform. He is wearing the grey overalls with MTS, Maglev Transportation Services, the logo of the maintenance company he has infiltrated. He has an official pass to the station. Nobody questioned him when he joined the team the day before, even though he was carrying rather more equipment than anyone else. He is an African man who shuffles his feet when he walks. He has broad shoulders supporting an overlarge head. He never smiles. The badge he is wearing identifies him as Ardan Dao, although this is not his real name. He has already set up two miniature cameras of his own, one on the platform, one on the train. These have magnetic strips to hold them in place and divide Red Circle with a limited but perfectly adequate view of what is happening. They will also have watched him as he set about the second part of his work, placing miniaturized thermobaric bombs in different parts of the train, also known as vacuum bombs, and first used in the War of Taiwan in 2038, the devices are designed to detonate twice. The first explosion disperses particles of metallic hydrogen into the air. The second ignites them. The result is a blast wave of such extreme pressure and heat that the devastation will fall not far short of a nuclear bomb. Ardan Dao has attached six of them. A miniature radio transmitter connects each device to the Red Circle. They will be activated just as the train leaves the station, when it will be directly beneath the shard. The aim is not just to destroy all the servers, effectively wiping out all the information that Biogenesis has stored. That would not be enough for the Red Circle. They also intend to bring down the shard, killing everyone who works inside it and anyone unlucky enough to be in the immediate vicinity. They estimate that between 2,000 and 3,000 people will die. The train is due to depart at 11 o'clock, which is a little over 2 hours from now. That is when the Red Circle will send Mycroft Holmes a message he will never forget. Meanwhile, Sherlock Holmes is still in bed at 221 Baker Street. He is in the no man's land between sleep and waking up, a place we have all visited when dreams are at their most vivid and our memories at their most confused. Diogenes. I can hear music playing. The extraordinary sound of two violins, a haunting tune from Eastern Europe. Champagne, caviar, waiters passing me on both sides. A woman more beautiful than any I've ever encountered. I know she is lying to me, but I do not tell her that I know. Why not? Because I do not want to offend her. Because she means something to me. She affects me in a way I do not quite understand. But this is not Diogenes. Diogenes is not a club. This is Bohemia, under the arches near Waterloo Station. Think again. Who is Diogenes? The image shatters. The violinists, the men in their Napoleon hats, the chandeliers, all that is torn away in a dazzling burst of light. Now I am somewhere that frightens me. I would rather be anywhere else than where I am, but here is all I know. It is the only place I have ever been. I am naked. I am strapped to a metal table. I am surrounded by machinery. A plastic drip is connected to my arm, feeding me some chemical from a transparent bag above my head. A doctor goes past, wearing a white badge on his lapel. Have I had an accident? Am I in hospital? Think. Slow things down. Rewind. I focus on the doctor and read the badge that he is wearing. Not Diogenes. Biogenesis. They have made me their prisoner. And I have seen one of them before, or perhaps I am going to see them again, an ugly man with no hair. We just want to take you back where you belong. I knew that voice. He told me his name and he said that he knew me. We had met before.
at Biogenesis. Mycroft was there. Mycroft. Holmes. The pieces are beginning to take shape, but the whole picture does not form. Now I am lying in a hospital bed and a figure is leaning over me in the darkness. I have to go. I'm leaving you behind, but when you get out of here, and you will get out of here, you must come and find me. Who is it speaking? Again, like some fantastic kaleidoscope, the image shatters, and now I'm falling. Falling from a great height. I hit cold, oily water and know at once that I am in the Thames. I cannot swim. I am too exhausted, and there is a terrible pain in my head where I have injured myself. I let the water carry me away, perhaps to my death. I no longer care. I have suffered enough. I am in the water for a long time. I am powerless, a drowning rat, but even so I am grateful as the current pulls me away from wherever I have been. I thought he was my friend. I thought he would protect me. I never imagined what he might have become. I am still in the water. I see ancient stone steps, and with the last of my strength, I swim towards them. I stretch out with one hand, feeling the hard surface with its strands of thick, slimy moss. Somehow, I manage to pull myself out. Children. In bizarre outfits. One in a top hat and boots reaching up to her knees. One in a tailcoat. One in a padded jacket carrying some sort of sword. They seem to have no eyes. They have found me, and so I am theirs. They take everything I have. Not just the contents of my pockets, but the pockets too. My clothes. And they would have taken my life, but for the arrival of the man who is my true friend. Why should he want to help me? Why should he put his own life at risk for a stranger? Could it be that I have found the one man in this vile city who has a good heart? The hospital. Nurse Hudson. Baker Street. I am waking up. I can feel the clean sheet beneath me. I remember the events of the night before. The man in the house was Jonathan Blore. He works for Biogenesis. Who is Moriarty? That is what I ask him. But I know. I know. Watson is throwing a few things together for breakfast when Holmes finally appears, his hair tousled and his eyes still full of sleep. It is well after 10 o'clock, late even by his standards. They are chanting once again next door. The two men can hear the music at the top of the house. You're late, Watson says. There's not much in the fridge. When did you finish the last of the bacon? I haven't had any bacon, Holmes protests, but I'd like some now. Well, you're out of luck. We're down to toast and jam. Holmes looks around him, and suddenly he is alert. Watson sees the switch. A moment ago he was half awake, slumping at the table. Now he is sitting up, looking at the kitchen as if seeing it for the first time. Someone has been here, he says.
What?
The bacon. And look, the mug beside the sink. That wasn't there when we left. Are you saying that burglars broke in and helped themselves to breakfast? No. He pounces out of the kitchen, and John hears him climb the stairs. A moment later, he is back. Missy has been here, he announces.
She's not here now.
She ate the bacon, she made herself tea. And this... Holmes misses no detail. He has seen a folded document on Missy's bed and quickly unfolds it. He finds himself examining the plans that she brought from West Norwood.
Where is this?
John asks.
What's it doing here?
She brought it back here to show it to us. It's a blueprint of this house, before it was adjusted.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm talking about the key to this whole mystery, Watson. Didn't I tell you at the very start that there was something valuable in this house? Well, I was right. I just didn't see what it was.
And what was it?
It's space. But they already have it. He points at the plans with an elongated finger. See here, there should be a door leading to a parlour next to the front door. It's gone. The bedroom occupied by a landlady has lost its fireplace. One wall has been moved. What must once have been an impressive reception room on the first floor has been cut to half the size. And the attic? That's interesting.
What is?
It has shrunk in size. That, I think, is where we should begin, and we have no time to waste.
Why?
Missy knew that she was in danger. That was why we persuaded her to stay in West Norwood. She would only have come back if she had discovered something of importance, and these plans must be the reason. But she's not here. She could have gone out. Without leaving a note? I think she's next door. Then why don't we go and ask? Because the mendicants will lie to us just as they did last time we were there. Oh yes, mendicant from the Latin word mendum, which also gives us the word liar. And nay, nimium doesn't mean not much, as they told us, it means not too much. The man who called himself Dominic, I have no doubt that is not his real name, made a point of telling us that he had no interest in the concept of time, and yet only a few moments before he had informed us that his evening meditations began precisely at 10 o'clock. And finally, there was Guillaume. What about him? You didn't notice the nicotine stains on his fingers? For a religious group that eschews anything that is not necessary, you would have thought smoking would be a strange choice of habit. But then all that nonsense he told us about the group was exactly that. Nonsense. I think Missy realized the truth of 221B Baker Street and went round to confront them. That is where we will find her now. We should call Lestrade. We don't have time to wait for Lestrade.
You have your revolver.
Yes. Then follow me. Holmes does not make for the front door, but climbs up to the attic, signalling to John not to make any sound. A trapdoor opens in the top hallway, and he reaches up with the pole that Missy keeps there, hooking a set of folding steps which he pulls towards him.
Why the attic?
John whispers.
Because it leads to the roof.
They climb into the narrow space that actually runs along the entire terrace of houses. John sees at once that although the wall on the left, between Missy and the Polish family at 219 Baker Street, is made of wood, the wall on the right is brick, more recently built. The new wall also steals space from what should be her property. The chanting is much louder here. It's almost as if the mendicants are performing in their own attic. There is no way through the brick wall, but the attic has a skylight, and Holmes pushes it open, signalling to John to help him up. He pulls himself onto the roof, then reaches back to give John his hand. The two of them find themselves sitting on the tiles with a view of the wasteland behind Baker Street. It's lucky that it hasn't rained for a while. What would be the ultimate slippery slope holds them secure. 221B does not have a skylight. Sherlock doesn't hesitate. Missy is quite possibly in danger, and he will do anything to reach her. He pulls out one of the tiles from the neighbouring roof and throws it far away onto the ground below. He continues. The tiles come out very easily, exposing a strip of asphalt which he tears back. There are wooden boards below. He has come prepared. John hadn't noticed him pick up a knife in the kitchen, but now he takes it from his pocket and uses it to prise the boards loose. The first one takes the longest, the nails resisting his efforts. But once he has pulled this one up, he is able to use his hands to get a good grip on the others, and within a few minutes, he has created an entrance. The chanting continues, the words, in Sanskrit, drifting up towards the sky. But there are no cries of alarm as two seeming burglars break in. Nobody notices that part of the roof has just been demolished. John sees why, the moment they drop down. A pair of sophisticated speakers are turned towards Missy's house, linked to a laptop computer which sits on a table nearby. This is what Missy has been listening to day and night for the past 3 years. A recording. There is a large silver machine in the far corner of the room, an electrical generator. It is humming softly, powering the rest of the house. It is surrounded by satellite dishes, pointing to the roof. John wonders why all this equipment is necessary. The generator, for example. All the other buildings in Baker Street have a reasonably good power supply. Many of them even have phone lines. Why the satellite dishes?
Now we must take care, Holmes whispers. We have the element of surprise. Let us see where it takes us.
He opens a trapdoor, identical to the one in 221, then lowers a second set of folding stairs. He and John climb down to a corridor with doors leading into the rooms where the mendicants sleep. Despite the austerity of the front room, there is nothing simple or restrained about the decor here. There are pictures on the walls. The bedrooms are cluttered with brightly coloured quilts, ordinary clothes strewn on the floor, cigarette butts in ashtrays, bottles of alcohol. Everything is a mess, a total contrast with the life presented on the lower floor. They take all this in, then proceed to the main staircase. John has his gun in his hand. The chanting, still playing over their heads, will at least disguise the sound of their movements. They make their way down, passing an equally messy kitchen and living room. There are unwashed plates and glasses, more bottles, a couple of pornographic magazines left on the floor. Cigarette smoke hangs in the air. It's more like an American frat house than a chapel. The further they go, the more they feel themselves to be in danger. The next flight of stairs brings them to the room that they visited, with its six plain chairs and makeshift altar. So far, they haven't seen anybody, and John is beginning to wonder if the house isn't empty after all. Holmes goes over to the door through which Guillaume appeared when they were last here. It is locked from the inside, but Holmes turns the key and discovers that it opens onto a narrow side alley between 221B and the neighbouring house, leading into Baker Street, with the scrubland behind. "Another mystery solved," he whispers. "This is how they leave the house, if they do not want to be seen. They can slip away in their ordinary clothes and enjoy their ordinary lives. The alleyway is not overlooked."
"That's lucky for them," John replies.
"I think not. They were the builders, after all. They left nothing to chance. But where are the mendicants?" The two of them return to the main room, and Holmes goes over to the grey curtain and pulls it aside. A pair of sliding doors, very modern, soundproofed, are revealed behind. Very gently, he pulls them slightly apart, and immediately they hear voices coming from below.
"You can't do this! Do you have any idea how many people are going to die?"
It is Missy's voice. "That's exactly the point, Miss Hudson." It is Dominic who replies.
"This is what we do." "But innocent people."
"Nobody is completely innocent. Not us, not you.
Now please shut up, or I'll have to put the gag back in."
John pushes past Holmes and makes his way down. He can't bear the thought of Missy being hurt. Still, he is careful not to reveal himself. The staircase is made of metal, and he has to tread softly to stop his shoes ringing out. As he descends into the basement of the house, an extraordinary spectacle meets his eyes, and in that instant, he understands exactly what this has all been about.